Harry Maguire that's just come out 30 years ago, and I got to see it again last night. It was just on TV, so it was very cool. But we're very glad that you're here, and Lee, thank you for being here. And we like to start off the podcast just by you telling us a little bit about yourself personally, like where you grew up, your family, that kind of background.
So I grew up in West Los Angeles, and I went to UCLA for a year. I had two parents that got 5 degrees between them from UCLA. And when I left and went off to Berkeley, it was characterized as running away from home.
Okay.
And but anyway, I went up in the, it was the tumultuous days of the 60s.
Sure.
And it was all happening in Berkeley. And I ended up student body president, and the governor of California was Ronald Reagan. And every time we demonstrated against the war in Vietnam, he cracked down. I learned everything I needed to learn about conflict and negotiating from interacting with Governor, later President Reagan.
Interesting.
And then I was a dorm counselor working my way through law school in a undergrad dorm, and they moved the freshman football team into the dorm, and one of the students was the quarterback, Steve Bartkowski. And I was on the way to probably being a DA or politics, but before I ever got there, Bartkowski had been the first pick overall in the 1975 draft, and he asked me to represent him. There I was, brimming with legal experience, never having practiced before, and I had the first pick in the draft, and there was a competitive football league then, the World Football League, and we got the largest rookie contract in NFL history.
Really? And what was that like? What was the dollar amount back then?
Now wait for it. Okay, it's going to be like Dr. Evil with 1 million. There, it was a $600,000 contract for 4 years. His signing bonus was $250,000. And his salaries were 40, 60, 100, and 130. And it made headlines because it was such a ridiculous amount of money.
What year was that?
1975.
Okay. So he went first, and you've had 7 other quarterbacks go or picks go first, right? NFL picks.
I had 64 first round draft picks in football, about 30 in baseball, about 7 in basketball, and then the first pick overall in the first round 8 different years. And then we have 12 players who are in the NFL or the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
Yeah, that's amazing. You mentioned you grew up in West LA, went to UCLA, became an agent. You were like, how old were you? In the early 20s,
25.
Right? 25 years old.
So. Yeah, I was just out of law school. I had traveled around the world after law school. I went to England and Greece and Italy and Israel and Egypt. I wanted to retrace all the different civilizations. But what kept me in representation was the seeing the high profile that athletes had and feeling like they could serve as role models.
Yeah.
And if they would retrace their roots and go back to the high school community that helped shape them, set up a scholarship fund or work with the church or Boys and Girls Club, they could put down roots. And at the collegiate institution, do the same thing. So Troy Aikman endowed a full scholarship at UCLA, yeah, but then recently gave them another $1 million. And at the pro level, I challenge each athlete to find something in their own life they'd like to tackle, and then set up a charitable foundation that would have leading business figures, political figures, and community leaders on an advisory board to execute a program. So that's like work done putting the 220th single parent and their family into the first home they'll ever own by making a down payment and moving them in, or Patrick Mahomes with his 15 and the Mahomies, where they help out rich kids that are in hospitals, kids that are hungry. So it's athletes making a difference. And so my dad had raised me with two core values. One was treasure relationships, especially family. So you judge yourself by, were you a good son? Were you a good father? Were you a good brother? Were you good in friendship with people that, were you there for your friends when it might cost you something to be there when they were in trouble? And then make a difference in the world in a fundamental way and try to heal pain and solve societal problems. So I was hardwired that way.
I noticed from your book, you talk a lot about your dad and your family. You acknowledge the acknowledgement part, you're acknowledging just a ton of people. You seem very grateful for all the people and friendships you had in your life. So I think you took your dad's word to heart, right? And you lived your life in that fashion. The name of your book's called The Comeback, right? You just had this recent book out. And I know Dr. Martin Luther King talked about the ultimate measure of any man is not where he stands in time of comfort and convenience, but where he stands in time of challenge and controversy. Obviously, you've been through high and low, and you're coming back again. Tell us about that journey.
There came a time in the early 2000s where there was a confluence of events that shook me. One was the death of my father, who, as you point out, had been a central figure in my life, a source of stability and inspiration. And he died a long, ugly death of esophageal cancer, and it was painful to watch. And I felt like I couldn't protect him. I couldn't save him. Maybe it was grandiose to think that I had that kind of power in the first place, but I felt frustrated. And then we owned a home near the beach in Newport Beach that got mold, toxic mold in it, and we had to move out in a day and then knock the house to the ground so we wouldn't involve somebody else in having that problem. And then my two boys were diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, which is an eye disease, which ultimately you become blind. So they became blind. And I felt powerless. I couldn't save my father. I couldn't provide the right house. I couldn't save my kids or cure them from the disease. And I turned to the wrong thing. I turned to alcohol to blunt out the pain. And I had not been a big drinker growing up.
Yeah.
There was no alcohol in our house. And I didn't drink till college. And then I drank beer, and they dubbed me One Beer Steinberg. And that was the way it was. But yeah. I moved out of our family house, separated from my wife, and I was in an apartment alone for the first time and very depressed. And I found out that it's actually legal in the state of California to consume alcohol during the light of day. And since I'd mostly consumed alcohol late at night, that allowed me to get a high alcohol level up. So it was just a spiral, and I spiraled down, and eventually I was in denial. I didn't think I had a problem. Other people would point it out, but alcoholism is a disease that tells you you don't have a disease. Other people have the problem, but not you. So eventually I was able to break denial, and I moved back into my parents' house in West Los Angeles near Westwood. And my only cogent thought as I sat there in a park nearby was, where can I find more vodka? And I'd been reduced to that, so I had closed up my business. I had given it to the younger agents. I closed my condo.
What year was that?
2010.
Okay.
And eventually, I went off to sober living. Once I broke denial, I realized that there's lots of help available, and you don't have to do it alone. So I worked a 12-step program with a unique fellowship, got a sponsor, went to multiple meetings, went to the International AA Convention in San Antonio, went to everything. I read every book I could think, and I figured I was an expert in my field, but I was completely ignorant when it came to understanding how alcohol rewires your brain. So I would go to the meetings and look for the old timers and just listen. It was like going back to college again. And I just got busy and got into action. When I was sitting in my parents' house, I had an epiphany. And I thought, my dad brought me up with these core values. I was failing as a parent. I wasn't making a charitable difference in the world. What excuse did I have? I wasn't a starving peasant in Darfur. I wasn't Steinberg in Nazi Germany in the 30s. I didn't have any major health issues other than the alcohol. What excuse not to try again? So the book, The Comeback, details that story. And it's based on the premise that life will set all of us back. It could be health issues. It could be marital issues. It could be financial issues. It could be addictive issues. But inevitably, with all our preparation, something untoward happens. So the question is, how do you find hope? How do you find resilience? How do you see light at the end of the tunnel? How do you break the pattern of depression and despondency to get to a better place? And so I've included stories of Troy Aikman and Steve Young and Warren Moon and Patrick Mahomes and adversity they faced to try to show the universality of the problem. And in March, I turned 16 years continuously sober.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And life is exciting and happy now.
That's great. Thank you for sharing that story in the book. Yeah, the book's a fantastic book. I did get a chance to read it, and there's some things in there that just I learned about sports that I didn't know. And you mentioned Steve Young. I remember when I went to UCLA, I think the best football game I saw between two quarterbacks was Steve Young against Steve Bono. In that game, I think BYU won 37-35, and Bono threw for 399 yards. Steve Young threw for 277 yards and felt like he ran for 500. He only ran for like 70 or so, but it felt like that just because he just had amazing wheels, right?
So about 5 years later, the roster of the San Francisco 49ers, the starting quarterback was Joe Montana.
Right.
The backup was Steve Young and backed up by Steve Bono.
That's right. Oh, my gosh. I forgot. The guy from Pennsylvania and UCLA was the backup. Oh, yeah. And that was Bill Walsh was the coach.
He was the coach, but the only reason Steve signed in San Francisco, because Tampa Bay was drafting Vinny Testaverde, and so somebody had to go, was that Bill Walsh promised Steve that Joe Montana had such a bad back that he'd retire. Now, I live part-time in the Bay Area. I would never have moved a quarterback behind a living legend, an icon like Joe Montana. And Steve, who was making the fifth most money in the NFL and would have started for basically 30 teams.
That's right.
Had to sit behind Montana because when he came there, it resurrected Montana. Mm. He was like a competitive junkyard dog. And Steve struggled with that. Luckily, he went to law school and used the time productively.
Did he sit for, was it 2 years around? How long was that?
It was into three.
Yeah. It showed some resiliency on his part, and obviously had a great Hall of Fame career after that. But that shows something about Steve Young. What are some of the players that you most identify with that you represented? That you just say these are not just great players, but just great human beings.
So my longest stewardship was with Warren Moon, and in 1978 there was still a lot of suspicion in pro scouting ranks that a black quarterback didn't have the intellectual prowess or leadership skills to be a NFL quarterback. And so they kept trying to change Warren's position, but he insisted on being a quarterback, and because that's MVP of the Pac-10. So he went to Canada instead because he wanted to play, and he spent 6 years there, and he came back and played 17 in the NFL, And probably the greatest honor of my career was him asking me to present him when he became the first African-American quarterback in the modern era to be inducted into the Hall of Fame.
Really? So you got to go to Canton?
Yes, and I gave the speech and got to go to the luncheon and rode in a car with him like, who's that funny guy looking guy next to Warren Moon? And then he put together the Crescent Moon Foundation, which sent kids to college on his scholarships. So he actually went back and he put together a high school scholarship fund. The field is named after him at Hamilton High, and a scholarship at the University of Washington, and then did Crescent Moon, which operated in multiple cities.
And you both went to Hamilton High.
We right? did.
Yeah.
Yes.
I didn't live too far from there. I lived in Palms. So not,
exactly.
Not too far from there.
Yeah, we had Al Michaels and Joel Siegel, a whole group of people that, and then eventually some pretty good athletes, Sidney Wicks, and Hamilton was probably 85% Jewish and 15% blacks. And the year I was a senior, they went to the city finals in basketball. Of course, the other team, which was, I think, Jordan High or Jefferson, the first five players that Hamilton had were very competitive, but then Jefferson rolled out the second five, and then the third five, and ran us off the court.
Yeah, we had some pretty good basketball back then, and Vernon Day, other teams like that just were phenomenal, stuff like that. So Warren, named after your dad, same name, right? So it resonated with you as well. Nick Saban recently retired a couple of years ago, right? And one of the reasons he retired, he was in a meeting, or not a meeting, like a get-together with the families and the kids and his wife, who was very part of this whole process at Alabama. And all they were talking about was money and NIL. And him and his wife looked at each other and go, why are we doing this still? This isn't why we got into this game. We got into to develop kids, to develop leaders, to men. It's time to get out. And they did get out after that. So what are your kind of thoughts on where the college game is going, the NIL, and how that's affecting the NFL and the draft and all that kind of stuff?
So there have been three major developments that have redrawn college sports as we once knew it. The first is NIL. NIL was a good concept at the beginning because certain players, athletes, student athletes, would sit on a campus and they didn't have as much material ability as did their non-athletic peers who could work during the school year, and they felt ripped off. So it could have been a simple fix as giving an athlete in need another $5,000. Instead, Nancy Skinner, a state senator here in California, put SB 206 together in 2020, and it said that California athletes could hire a marketing director and market themselves and make money from endorsements. So the fact California was going to sign all the best athletes meant that it went national quickly, but without forethought or regulations and without guardrails. And so it's morphed into a system where quarterback Underwood at Michigan enrolls at LSU, and they offer him $4 million. And then a big alum from Michigan comes along, offers him $14 million, and he never plays a down for LSU, and he goes straight to Michigan. So you have money wars that are occurring high school to college. And then you have a second bite at the apple, which is the transfer portal.
Right.
And players are transferring twice. It just changes the game. And then you have conference realignment.
Yes.
So I went to Berkeley, and when you walk across the campus, you look out at the majesty of the Pacific Ocean. And we're now in a conference, the ACC, that looks at the Atlantic Ocean. What happened to the concept of student athletes who actually didn't take cross country?
3,000 miles,
yes.
Right.
And what happened to regional rivalries? In other words, UCLA used to play Cal, and they called it All Cal Weekend, and it was a big deal. Not anymore.
I remember driving up for those games or Stanford games.
Yes.
And yeah, those were great rivalries and they were fun. And you're right. It's like, what happened to the student athlete? But I do agree with you. There's kids who were going through training camp. They get food, they get fed. But when it's off season, you have a lot of athletes who are just struggling to get to eat.
And they don't have a car and right. they don't live right. in a nice place right. and their non-athletic peers do. My whole career has been spent trying to compensate individuals for their skill set. Yeah. So it feels uncomfortable to be challenging a system. But the problem is where we're going is you will have four super conferences that have the big alumni groups, the big alumni base, collectives that can contribute.
Right.
And they'll sign all the talented players. So there'll be a big gap between the SEC and the Big Ten and all the other conferences. And eventually I think that the super conferences will get rid of the NCAA and they'll end up doing their own TV negotiations and put their own rules together. What we're seeing is Star Wars on the free agency without limitation.
But Kurt Cignetti figured it out with Indiana. Well, he had Mark Cuban, though, right?
Yeah.
Can help a little bit.
Texas Tech all of a sudden became a national championship contender.
That's right.
Because they bought the guys. But a couple of years ago, the most money that was spent on NIL was Ohio State. And, oh, incidentally, they won the national championship.
Yes, they dominated. They looked pretty good. You're probably one of the foremost authorities on the draft. How has NIL impacted the draft, or has it?
It has this impact, that the quarterback at Oregon stayed in school where he could have come out. His NILs meant that whatever the number was, $5-6 million, he was in good financial shape. So the positive effect is it could keep young athletes in college longer instead of jumping to the pros. So that part of it's a plus, but you take the best, the first pick in last year's NBA draft, Cooper Flagg, and it's reported he made anywhere from $14 to $20 million in his last year at Duke. That's more money than he would receive the first year of his salary capped NBA contract.
Yeah. His rookie contract is less than what is NIL. And I remember the Texas quarterback stayed longer, I guess, to somewhat to the detriment of Arch Manning, right? Ewers? I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right. Because he was getting $4 million,
right.
And he wasn't going to make that in the NFL.
But Arch Manning didn't come out last year.
No.
And again...
No, he stayed. That's
yes.
right. So it's interesting. So you're right. Maybe the blessing is that some of these players stay a little bit longer and develop and go 3-4 years instead of 1 or 2 years in the NFL. So when you're, let's go back to when you started your business. So you had your one athlete, Steve Barkowski. When did it hit on you that this is a scalable business, being a sports agent, and I could get not just one athlete, but I could build a business around this?
The key was being able to profile players, to find young men that cared about second career, find young men that cared about being role models, to find young men that cared about health and wellness. I've campaigned on the concussion issue and have a concussion foundation. So the first year after Bartkowski, I met with a zillion players and signed a few. And I thought I'm going to have to reshape this, because if someone does care about being a role model, is a high character player, if I can find their parents and those families and do some research on the players. And then it didn't take me long to realize that in football, the key player was the quarterback.
Yeah,
I got to the point in the 80s where I was representing half the starting quarterbacks in the league, and that they had longer careers, were paid much more than other players, could do endorsements and could be fabulous role models. And so by readjusting the approach, then it pretty quickly grew. And I had a period from 1989 to 1995 where there were 7 years, and six of them I had the first pick in the draft.
In the movie Jerry Maguire, there's the pivotal scene close to the end when Jerry is trying to get back with Renee Zellweger, his wife. He talks about being good. This is what he's good at, being in the living room talking. Was that something that you were good at negotiating, or just not just negotiating, but resonating with the parents and the student and the potential athlete?
Ruben, it's all listening skills. It's, can you create an atmosphere of trust around parents and a young man so they will cut below the surface level of responses and tell you what their true focus and goal is? It's drawing them out so that I get into their heart and mind and understand their deepest anxieties and fears and greatest hopes and dreams. If I can bond on a deeper level and find out, like with a best friend, what someone truly feels, but men don't share so easily all the time. I'm sure the women in our audience will concur with that. So that you have to draw someone out.
Yeah.
And then I want to know, how do you feel about short-term economic gain, long-term economic security, spiritual values, geography, family, being a starter, being on a winning team, the quality of coaching, and represent each person, not generically, but individually, in terms of who they are deep in their heart and soul.
Wow. What's it like on the other side when you're negotiating with a Jerry Jones or an owner? What, any tidbits you can share with us?
We did Troy's first contract with Jerry Jones. Now, the great thing about dealing with an owner is I'm a concept negotiator. My partner, Jeff Morad, was grinded out on the ground. He would say, I don't care about the arbitrators, get the money. And so I would be like in the plane over the battlefield.
Yeah.
And my way of negotiating is to lay out a rationale for why this sum is the right one and to try to convince the other person. Anyway, Jerry, I remember one day we were talking on a cell phone. And I said, Jerry, I want $9 million. And he said, son, that dog won't hunt, which I took to mean he wasn't accepting the offer. And so I'm on a cell phone, and you think of it as a private form of communication, but it's not really. It's like going out over the airways.
Sure.
I said, Jerry, this is really fair. He said, son, we passed fair about $8 million ago. And I said, but it's got to be, I said, it's got to be 10. He said, no. Then I was 10, 9, back and forth and everything. And all of a sudden, his voice comes over the cell phone and says, listen, buddy, if you don't want the money, I do. Take the deal. So that got settled.
Yeah. That's quite, you must have a zillion stories when you talk about negotiating and stuff. What, and you've had such a great career. Was there one thing in your, you can point out in your career that was just one of the most fantastic moments of your career?
I think the three highlights are having a player who's first picked overall.
Okay.
Having a quarterback who wins a Super Bowl. And so as Steve Young had been behind Montana all those years, and Montana never threw an incompletion in their mind's eye, and so he's always struggling against that. So he wins a Super Bowl, he's MVP, and I ran down on the field, and he ran up and hugged me, and he said, the monkey's off my back, the monkey's off my back. So that was pretty special. When Troy won his three Super Bowls was special. The charitable and community moments are special. So I'm in a banquet with Warren Moon, and he says, will everyone stand up here that's been used my scholarship? And you look at this whole room stand up, and it's really thrilling because you've change the arc of their lives.
That's right.
And so at the end of it, it's the charitable and community programs that I feel like is the biggest accomplishment from these 50 years. We've, in aggregate, our guys have raised $1.3 billion for charities.
That's a lot of impact. Definitely a lot of impact. I didn't get to ever go to one of your Super Bowl parties. I used to go to a Super Bowl party that was put on by advertising agents, and all they did was watch the commercials. They wouldn't even watch the game. But is there any one Super Bowl party that sticks out to you?
There are so many of them. So this is 3,000 to 5,000 of my closest friends in an iconic venue. So a couple of years ago in L.A., we used Sony Studios, the old MGM.
Sure.
Or last year in New Orleans, we used the Jazz Museum. So it's iconic. There was a Super Bowl party in Miami where Haiti was in the middle of a cholera epidemic, and people were dying because of impure water. And we raised enough money that we sent a water machine straight to Haiti from the party that purified the water for 140,000 people a day and, you know, saved their lives. So another year we did autism. We, in New Orleans, moved a single mother and her family into the first home they'll ever own by making the down payment and moving them in. And now we do brain health summits at those parties. And that's because I had a crisis of conscience back in the 80s representing all those quarterbacks that keep getting hit in the head. And we would go to doctors and ask, how many is too many? What's the magic number? They had no answers, Ruben. They didn't know. And so we held the first concussion conference in 1994 and had Troy Aikman and Steve Young and Warren Moon and Drew Bledsoe and Rob Johnson and other players there. And we continue having them. And that led to the Concussion Foundation being set up. I just figured I'm not doing my job if I'm just stacking dollars into a bank book and someone goes down the road to dementia.
Yep. No, that's a good point. I saw that you work with Dr. Amen as well. He's pretty significant in that arena, right?
He's great. And when I finished my drinking career, I went to Dr. Amen, and he blew my brain up on a big screen. And you could see where alcohol damaged the brain. Hmm. And then 15 years later, I've done it again, and the brain's healed. But he's a pioneer.
He is a pioneer. I can't believe we're butting up against our time, but anything for people who are going through kind of the struggles that you went through that you want to share with them?
Yes, there is hope. So if you're despondent, depressed, confused because of a problem with substance abuse, just know there's hope. You can be resilient. You can rebuild your life. You don't have to do it alone. There are loads of people. I had massive amounts of help in this process. I never could have done it alone. The Comeback shares stories. You can get it on Barnes & Noble, and there's an audio edition. But if I can help one person who's out there struggling, confused, then the comeback's been a success.
That's great. Lee, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing these great stories with us, and look forward to seeing you down the road.
And I think we can arrange an invitation to next year's Super Bowl party.
There we go. We have Bad Bunny. Our admin is a big Bad Bunny fan.